I'm the doctor, by the way.
You're listening to Pieces of Eighth, the Doctor Who podcast for which nothing gets in the way of bringing you details about the making of something Eighth Doctor, not even death. We're on the trail, as ever, of those sections of the Doctor Who universe that feature the incarnation of the Time Lord as played by Paul McGann. I'm Kenny Smith, and I have a familiar voice as my stand-in co-host this week.
Because I'm Matt Michael.
Are you?
Hi, Kenny.
You are. I was joking.
I don't know. Matt Michael, who am I? I don't know.
Oh, it sounds like a documentary. Why don't we ask them to make one, get Vanessa Yule to come over and follow you about?
Yeah, I could go to some random fan's house and look at their merchandise. I'd enjoy that, I think.
They could give you abuse and just complain about your reviews. Why did you not like this story? Why did you not like that story, Matt?
I'm going off the idea.
Okay, right. We'll not do that instead. But great to see you again. And thanks once again for stepping in to cover for, I suppose we should say, the former Bumpy, because we've been recording these episodes way out of order. Becca's, of course, had her little baby. And he's doing very well, mother and son very well. And congratulations to them on the arrival.
Brilliant. No, she's got a separate Dalek bump now.
She certainly
does. A Dalek bump all of his own.
Yes, absolutely. But yes, it's lovely that, that's here. And I've just done something that's made Matt laugh, but nobody in the world will know what it is. So there we go. But I suppose, Matt, since last we spoke, there's been a fair bit of Eighth Doctor merchandise revealed, not least starting with the thing that we were both just holding up before we started recording.
Yeah.
The new TV movie poster that came with DWM.
Yeah, it's gorgeous, isn't it? I think I sort of unfolded it, and because it was on the inside of the poster, and I wasn't quite sure what to expect. But I guess they had to go with the TV movie, really. But I was wondering whether they were going to go with the Night of the Doctor, Power of the Doctor style costume. So I think we all know that the TV movie costume exists in legal limbo at this point. So I wasn't sure whether they'd be able to go with it or not.
Yeah, unfortunately. But obviously the cover for the next Eighth Doctor range with Audacity, the new companion, which Big Finish have announced, the first of two box sets. Beautiful recreation of the look that he had in some of the DWM comic strips, particularly Children of the Revolution.
Absolutely gorgeous. And I do have the Toys R Us blue coated figure as well. So I'm going to be digging that out for when I'm listening to Audacity.
Yep.
Audio Audacity.
Which is ironically the name of the software that I use to edit this podcast. So. yes, I've just got Stead Action figure down from my shelf. He's now actually my current eighth Doctor, because I swap them around as to which one I have as front and centre in my lineup of all the Doctors. So, oh, you've got the one with the bag, as it should correctly be known, the Kenny Smith bag, as I'm the one who insisted that went in there. So, yeah, thanks everyone. Please write in saying I'm great. You don't need to, I'm only joking. But of course, we've also had the Forbidden Planet reveal of their 60th anniversary merchandise as well, with some Eighth Doctor content using the Night of the Doctor look.
Yes. Yeah, and they've been sort of going through Doctor by Doctor, haven't they? I do need to make it over to Forbidden Planet at some point and see if I can pick myself up. An Eighth Doctor.
I'm looking at it just now. We've got the Eighth Doctor mug, which has got it just says the Eighth Doctor in the TV movie font. There's a coaster again with the Night of the Doctor. Looks like some sort of sweatshirt again saying the Eighth Doctor, and there's a T-shirt version as well in male and female versions. So. Plenty new things.
I could have a cup of tea from Paul McGann's face while wearing Paul McGann's face and then putting my cup down on Paul McGann's face.
Yeah. I could almost think that you're obsessed with Paul McGann's face here, but Yes. We'll not go into that because we're not that kind of podcast. We're a very polite, family friendly, most of the time, chatty about Doctor Who podcast. Mm. But great. Anyway, Matt, thanks once again for joining us, because it wouldn't be a season of Pieces of Eight without your dulcet tones joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. No, always, always happy to be on board. So you join us as we resume our quest to feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, whether on screen, in books, novellas, full cast audios, short stories, comics, animations, talking books, magazines, and more. This week, we are going to head back to the world of Big Finish's Short Trips to bring you a very timey-wimey story from Volume 11 of their collections. It's Death Will Not Part Us by Alfie Shaw.
It certainly is. So, Matt, how's that reading voice of yours doing today? Can you tell us what the Big Finish website has to say about the aforementioned Death Will Not Part Us?
On the 14th of August, 3097, everything is fine on the world of Guernica, except on the same day, the planet is being destroyed. Also on the 14th of August, 3097, no one in the universe has heard of Guernica. The planet's only chance to survive the horrors of the Time War lies with Viola Wintersmith, for Viola has a weapon that can destroy anything that stands in her way. A weapon that requires a unique form of ammunition. Her past.
Thank you, Matt. That was beautifully read. So let's hear a very quick clip from the start of the story, which sets the scene.
It is the 14th of August, 3097, and all is peaceful on the world of Guernica. It is the 14th of August, 3097, and Guernica screams in terror, caught up in a war beyond its comprehension. It is the 14th of August, 3097, and Guernica has never existed. Each of these is the indisputable truth. Yet the woman who sat on the steps of Unity Hall would never know of that undisturbed day. Time had been rewritten. For now and forevermore, a month after her wedding, someone destroyed her world. She often thought of that first, last day. She had to, in order to load her weapon, but tried to never linger on its events. Not on when the wheezing harbinger materialized above Unity Hall, nor on when the sky splintered and the people became bodies and the bodies became dust. Not even on when she picked up the rifle that fell from broken heavens. She first fired out of desperation, in defense of a world she knew was already dead. Later, it devolved into a frustrating necessity. Eventually, she learned to hit the harbinger, although it made no difference beyond a short-lived period of satisfaction. She was always ready to be rid of these final hours, but they were never enough. She had to give more to the weapon, or else it wouldn't fire, and she would die along with her world. It needed the preceding days, the blissful weeks she had spent married to Sam Wintersmith. It was only the knowledge that she would see her family again that clawed that month away from her and into the weapon. But there was always one day that made her pause. The final one she needed to feed into the weapon to arm it. The day she became Mrs. Viola Wintersmith.
So it's a baffling one. It's very, very clever, isn't it? And there's absolutely no other way that this story could be told other than in the Time War.
No, it's absolutely absolutely rooted in the Time War. And it's a really interesting... I think the short story form and the short trip form really lets Alfie Shaw go to town with just the effects of the Time War and the idea of like history itself being torn apart, which the Time Lord Council were talking about in The End of Time. But it's quite difficult to put that across in a full story because it's so weird. And you kind of, if you have to listen to it for sort of 50 minutes, an hour, it would probably lose you. just in terms of the oddness of it. You have to have sort of more structured narrative if you're going to do a story or a box set about the Time War. But when you do these little vignettes about the impacts of the war, you can really go out there with what you do. And I think this one really goes out there.
It definitely does. I think the fact that it's, you know, the way it's structured, we follow Viola through her life, and then it gets so far, and then all of a sudden, dum-ba-da-dum, we're back to the start, and the theme tune's going again, and it's being introduced once more, and it's just such a, it's a brilliant conceit that we're getting the same story, but different, you know, set throughout different times in Viola's life, as she gives away different parts of it. To fire in this time weapon, and the Doctor showing up and getting killed, or is he? And it's just that, I mean, I know, we all know that there's an awful lot of reset switches tend to be pressed in sci-fi stories, and in this case we're literally getting that, but it's the same but different, and we, here we go, the theme tune's there to break it up, and it's just, I think it's so cleverly done, particularly towards the end with the different theme tunes, so we know that time has changed and we're getting different approaches.
And it's what I particularly admire about it is it's high concept, but it also has real emotion and feeling to it. So the whole piece revolves around Viola's wedding day, and she has to keep giving up pieces of her past every time that she fires the gun, and she fires the gun to try to save her future and her husband and her marriage and her relationship and her planet. But every time she does, she has to give away a chunk of her history and a chunk of her life that's brought her to the point where she's getting married. And I think it's really effective when they sort of replay the wedding, and there's fewer and fewer guests each time until it's really just her husband, the Vicar, and the Doctor ultimately, and she's had to give up everything else in the service of trying to save reality. So not only is it out there and clever, it's also quite moving and touching.
Yeah, it just shows the extent to which some people will go to save the day, and here you've got somebody who's obviously they're not even a companion or anything like that, and that's the sort of thing you'd expect a companion to do, let alone just somebody who's a guest character and giving everything up repeatedly. And then of course we get to I think spoilers for people who haven't heard it, we're now going to talk about it towards the conclusion, and then after she gives up her last day, then things change, and we get, from instead of going from the Time War theme, we're back to the normal David Arnold theme as time rebuilds itself. Yeah. And I thought that was the way Alfie describes it, sort of like, I think it was a Sunday appeared and then a Tuesday, and they were joined by Monday, and then Friday and Saturday popped up, and just the way that it all linked together. And you could almost imagine it like a crisscross pattern, sort of like line stretching out and becoming a grid.
Yeah. Now, I have a question for you, because I like that as well, but I kind of pictured at the end that it would be the Ninth Doctor, because it feels like the Time War's finished. So the David Arnold theme, I thought, surely it should really have been the Murray Gold theme at that point, and it should really have been the Ninth Doctor looking back on.
I think it was just to sort of, the way that I interpreted it was that, and this is not any insider knowledge, even though I've asked Alfie about it, but I interpreted it as being sort of like, it's back to sort of like the Eighth Doctor sort of watching things. Things are sort of calming down, and then of course, you know, there's that pause, and then it is into the Ninth Doctor. So that's the way I interpret it. And yes, technically, because it's in the Time War, it should still be the Time War theme, but I don't know if it was almost to imply that time's changed, so we've got the earlier Eighth Doctor theme, even though obviously the Time War is still ongoing. That's the way that I read it. I could be completely wrong. No doubt when Alfie's listening, he'll get in touch and let me know. But for me, it's brilliant. I think it is one that I can listen to again and again, because it's got those, it's because it's so clever, and you do pick up just teeny weeny details here and there, now and again, that maybe you didn't get on first or second listen.
And I think it's a really strong story in a really strong, actually, Short Trips collection. I think volume 11's really, really strong overall, with some great some absolutely great stories. Even the opening one with Sontarans is brilliant as well.
Yeah, it's another one by Alfie as well, which is it's very funny. And yeah, I think Alfie should write more. He's God, wait to hear what he's got in the 11th Doctor Chronicles coming up. It won't be revealed for a while yet, but oh, when he told me, it was like, oh my God, this is great, and I cannot wait to hear it. So
tease.
I do like to tease. Yeah, yeah, not what you expect. And I know I was like, you very sneaky man, Alfie Shaw. So there we go. But yeah, for me, I like this one, and I actually keep the MP3 version of it on my phone because I do enjoy listening to it. So I've got it. I've got it all there. So yeah. So Alfie, thank you very much for writing it, even though it was your second attempt at it. And as we're about to find out.
Is that a second attempt because he keeps rewriting time?
Yeah, probably lost the day where he wrote it and then erased it.
Probably. You've brought us several interviews which you did in LA so far this series. Is this another one?
Well, originally Alfie and I did plan to do it when we were out there, but instead we had an excellent night out with Jason Hay Gallery at Soho House in West Hollywood, where I drank rosé champagne all night. And also Adam Lambert was there, and I think he was wearing a bomber jacket which was covered in feathers, which is possibly the most Adam Lambert jacket possible. In the end, because we were very, very drunk, we didn't record it, and that would have made for a very, very, very different interview. So I just want to give a quick shout out to the last people standing. That was myself, Alfie, Matt, Daisy, Lauren, Emily, and Lizzie. Whoop, whoop. Party team, we are talking about doing a reunion in London, but yeah, we need to get that fixed, and I'll need to get down to London. Anyway, myself and Alfie did have a good few laughs at the Big Finish Cafe Clatch. That's a small gathering of fans with an invited guest or guests, and I went along to that as an attendee rather than as a guest, and unfortunately Edmonton and it was Matt Fitton and Alfie, and it then became a bit of a comedy gig with Alfie and I teasing each other as someone kept making Scottish references throughout whenever anyone Scottish was mentioned. No idea who that would be, but yeah. But it was a great convention. You really must do a Gallifrey someday if you haven't already.
I have to. I definitely need to go over. So yeah, my aim before the 70th anniversary.
That's a good aim to have.
So let's hear from the writer and producer, Alfie Shaw.
Hello, my name is Alfie Shaw, and I'm the writer of Death Will Not Part Us.
Alfie, welcome back to Pieces of Eighth.
Thank you very much for having me, Kenny. Always a delight. Always a pleasure to see you.
And it's always a pleasure to see you, although sadly the listeners can't see you sitting there as effortless stylish as ever. So
bless you. Yes,
it is.
I'm going to take that. Yeah. I don't agree with it, but I'm going to take it.
Oh, of course you should, because when we were at Big Finish Day a couple of years ago, when we were in that club at ridiculous o'clock in the morning, and I took a picture and put it on Twitter, just go, yay, great night out with great mates. And one of my friends got in touch to say, who's that guy?
Oh, bless them.
She was
very kind.
Yes, she thought you were rather lovely. So there we go. Effortless stylish. That's you. Anyway, we're not here to talk about your style today. We're here to talk about your short trip. So yes, as editor, I suppose that gives you the chance to pick and choose the doctors you'd like to write for.
Yes, this one sort of came about. It was sort of idea first rather than doctor led. You know, having come off 2 years of short trips was an interesting range to produce, because I very quickly started getting a lot of feedback on the stories as series 9 and 10 came out, but I couldn't really do anything with that advice because it was all recorded well in advance. He had 2 years worth of stuff. But one of the things that very people were clearly saying was we want more sort of experimental stories. I thought, okay, cool, well we'll do some Time War stuff that allows us to do some really weird and experimental stuff. And I came up with this idea of using people's actual pasts as weaponry and as a way of fighting in a Time War. And I shopped it round to a few people, and it didn't quite click with anyone. No one quite was delivering out that match of what I was imagining. So I thought, well, I'll take this one on then, which is also one of the reasons that I sort of cemented my decision to step away as producer. Because, well, I'm now doing two of these, that's, you know, a third of a box set. That's when the goal was really to try and get new different voices on this. So I'll do this run, but I'll step away, and then that'll mean that we've sorted this box set, and that's all good, and we've got this nice idea in there, but then a new producer will come in, new writers, and, you know, the fresh turnover will continue. But given the idea of it, it sort of had to be the Eighth Doctor, because the only other choice really is the War Doctor. But I feel the War Doctor's solution to this, especially the version of the War Doctor in my head, would be to somehow use that weapon, or just let this woman sort of use her lives up. You know, I very much subscribe to the sort of school of the very vicious War Doctor, just because I think I like the kind of character journey that it then takes 9 through 11 on. So it had to be 8. There was no point where it wasn't 8. It's interesting, on the TARDIS wiki page for this, it flags that war is in it, and I've never quite worked out why, because it's Doctors 8 and 9 technically, but yes, it's mainly 8 and not war, just to clear up that confusion which exists for some reason.
I mean, I think it's a fascinating concept. I mean, it's summed up on the summary in the website on the 14th of August 1397. Everything is fine in the world of Guernica, except on the same day the planet is being destroyed. Also on the 14th of August 1397, no one in the universe has heard of Guernica. So I think it's that wonderful sort of, like, it is and it isn't, and it's just that wonderful notion that so that you don't really get the chance to play with in anything other than Time War.
Yeah, it's a specifically unique set of toys to play with, because even though in a lot of Doctor Who stuff there is scope to do weird timey-wimey, you know, different structures and that sort of thing, the idea that there is a war, but because of what it does in Doctor Who, is sort of acting as like a reset for the whole series. There is theoretically a point in, this was kind of my coming to it, there is a universe. If you arrived on, I don't know, Croydon, 1986. You land in Croydon, 1986. Don't know why I picked that, but we're going for it. There is a version where if you land in Croydon, 1986, you are in the classic era of Doctor Who. The Time Lords are still alive and everything's fine. There is a version of Croydon, 1986, that's probably being used as a sledgehammer or something in a Time War. And then there is a version of 1986 where you land in the new series of Doctor Who, and the Time Lords are all dead. And all of those things are true. And it's something that the show, it's one of the sort of, like, the bendy nature of time in Doctor Who. You just kind of have to go with it. It's one of those, look, just go with us, please, on this, or else the whole thing falls apart. And so I wanted to do something that leaned into that and allowed us to sort of explore that.
I think a big part of this is music, and particularly the use of the different theme tunes, which I think is, because I remember you sent me this one to listen to before it came out, and I was just like, oh my god, this is just exactly what Time War stuff should be. And the fact that it's differentiated in that so clever and subtle way as things change, and that must have been so much fun for you to do. Just think, that's a great way to do it, just by using music, and you've got a different cue straight away.
Yeah, I was. That was one of the little touches I was quite pleased with, and also the kind of, like, it's such a shorthand for the listener, because we all know, you know, we're all so familiar with the Doctor Who, the various versions of the Doctor Who theme, that if you go, here's the David Arnold, you know, Eighth Doctor theme, you go, okay, cool, that's, you know, pre-Time War, it's that kind of nice romantic McGann era. There's the Time War theme. Oh no, he's at war, or he's trying not to be at war. And then obviously Eccleston, such a recognisable theme. But it was just a way of, how do I, with every, not just the words, not just the performance, how do I use some post-production element of this to convey the story? Because it's a weird thing writing a prose short trip, because you're not writing a prose short story, in that no one's going to read this other than the person we hire to read it. The script is, the text is not available out there. So you are even though you are writing a prose piece, you are creating a prose performance piece. So that's why this has, in the script, it has, you know, special effects directions, and it has music, and it has all those things marked out like you would do in a drama script, because we've done in sort of traditional or old school Chronicles format is what I think most people would think of as a kind of hybrid between audiobook and performance piece. But actually, all Big Finish, you know, apart from the old books, is all performance pieces. You know, it's a speaking book, but there is no physical copy of the book for you to pick up. So I wanted to cover as much as I could in the text to convey the post-production process and get everything on a thematic and production level to reinforce the core idea.
That does make sense. It does make perfect sense. I know what you mean. And so tell us a wee bit about the character of Viola. Where did she come from?
I don't know. It's very weird. I think I knew, because it's a short trip, it had to be about one person. And it had to be, especially since it's a huge conflict. You know, this isn't the place or the range to do big epic time war. You know, you're not doing the full frontal assaults and things. So I knew it had to be small. And the idea, I think it was because my sister's wedding was coming up. So I just sort of had weddings on the brain. And I thought, well, a wedding is quite a nice, it's one of those few places in your life where people from all parts of your, different strands of your life and your past come together. So you've got that, you've got birthday parties, funerals, which would have been a bit more morbid. But the idea of, if you wanted to show the impact on someone's life in a really shorthand kind of way, because you know you've only got 5,000 words, there's not a lot of time, you've really got to cut to it, having the church is full, there's less people, there's different people, you know, the sister has a different girlfriend at various points, it was an easy way of doing someone's life has changed because it's such a momentous life event. So it sort of, it's, she sort of came out as a result of that. And the other thing that then the wedding allowed you to do is have a constant in the vicar, who, obviously, spoilers, is the Time Lord agent who is there running this thing. And you could even, you have that sort of subtle hint that even while everything else is changing, the vicar is the same. So there is an outside person built into the structure of a wedding. That's really the one person there that none of the family really knows. So there is an inbuilt stranger to things. So the wedding seemed like an appropriate way and a useful way of conveying all that in a very short space of time. I don't know where the name came from. I do occasionally just sit down and write lists of names. It's like a 10-minute thing. You just don't stop writing. You just churn out names as a way of usefully generating character names. I think Wintersmith came from one of those. That's kind of where she came from, really. She was a product of setup. But I was okay with that because it gave her quite a strong emotional journey, and it gave her a very clear goal as well. There was a very tangible, she's off to save Sam, and even as the other people fade away, Sam is still there. So it's a shorthand way of knowing that she knows it works. It doesn't, because the wedding, they get a bit further, and as it things progress, they go, okay, this that she sort of drip fed this lie that it's working. And so there was an easy way, because then you have the honeymoon, and then you have these kind of very recognizable stages for people. So because it was built around an emotional journey that fed into, that allowed us to demonstrate, again, just come back to, you know, it's a short trip. you've really got one core concept and you've just got to explore that. Although admittedly, I would say that's also true of an hour's drama, but in a slightly different way. But everything was able to sort of facilitate that core idea of change and showing change in a very kind of shorthanded way, because you've got to let the audience has got you've got to convey this thing in a short space of time. So if you use a recognizable structure and recognizable events, you don't have to set up lots of different details about their lives, because most people would have been to a wedding or know the structure of a wedding from various entertainment formats from that. So the fact that she's a lawyer, I think, did come from the fact that my sister's a lawyer. So yeah, I think that was kind of where she came from. That was a really rambly answer, I'm so sorry.
No, not at all. Someone, I thought you were going to say
someone get
that.
Me a script editor.
What good are they? What have they ever done for anyone? No, I like to think that Wintersmith came from you, the fact you thought of me having a snowball fight.
Yes, that's totally right, Kenny. That's exactly where that came. Forget the thing about the list. That's what I was thinking.
Definitely, it's got to be that.
Thinking, my sister's wedding coming up, and I thought, you know what would really make that? Kenny having a snowball fight. I've got an idea.
Magic. I suppose with you as producer, did that add an almost like an extra pressure when you're writing these things? It's sort of like you're the one in charge, and there might be sort of like, you know, this is like the standard that we want, you know, from when people listen in. Or is it just one of those, I'm writing it, but let's just go on with it and carry on with the job?
That's interesting. I mean, there's always a pressure on yourself to do good work. What an obvious thing to say. There was, I think, the kind of just come back to what I said earlier about when I shopped it around to other people and it wasn't working for people. You know, it wasn't quite hitting the right levels of the sort of emotional journey from people. They weren't quite getting their head around the core concept. Just being able to take it on in that way, I think, was quite useful. The fact that it was kind of a one-off meant that it wasn't that much. You know, I'm currently doing a series of 11th Doctor stuff, and I'm currently working on the final volume of that. And that's got way more pressure on it because it's a big series, you know, it's a big series finale. Everything's been building up to this, and this has to deliver. Whereas what's quite nice about Short Trips is there isn't that, it is that selection box thing. And obviously you want everything to be as good as you can. And I thought the idea was very strong, and I thought it did some fun things with the mechanics, but it wasn't, there wasn't that kind of pressure as in I'm the boss, this must be good. It was just a, this is my name on it, you know, this must be good. And some, you know, I did rewrite it completely from scratch. I wrote it in a week and then binned all of that and started again because it didn't work, which, you know, sometimes you do. And so, and then the other one I did for this set, Rear Guard, I did in 2 days flat, three with changes. And that's just the way of these things. Sometimes they work, they flow really easily, and sometimes they're quite, it's a bit of a struggle to get them right. So there was a pressure on, there's always a massive pressure on me. I'm possibly a bit of an overthinker, to get it to be as high a quality as it could be. But that was more from my own pride and neuroses rather than, rather than I'm the boss and I must set the standard. I think it's only had to meet the standard. But as I was sort of alluding to earlier, there was a lot of lessons learned from series 9 and 10 that went into volumes 11 and 12 as they are now, because they're all collated, and the generally more positive backlash I think from both of those sets kind of bore out that it was the right direction to go in.
What about the recording? Were you along for that one?
I was not along for that one because I believe this was a lockdown recording off the top of my head. And so it was generally it was Scott, because this was recorded the same time as Salvage, the other Eighth Doctor Time War story from volumes 11 and 12. Blimey, when was this recorded? Will I have an email about it? Let's do some live inbox searching. Gripping for people.
Let's keep this in. Right now, Alfie has his hand under his chin. He's just put his thumb up, clenched his fist. like he wants to punch me in the face. He's now putting a finger.
No. Hang on. When did we say we were going to record? It recorded on. That's annoying. Hang on. Here we go. So it recorded 15th of October, 2021.
Wow.
So I think off the top of my head, they still had locked COVID procedures in place. So I did not go in. It was Scott and Adele. Yeah, so I didn't, you know, Scott's not only a brilliant director, but a brilliant producer. So I was available if anything needed to be sorted, but he knows what he's doing. You know, he can run a day. So I left it in his very capable hands and said, I'm down the phone if you need anything.
Yeah,
but it was just.
It must have been really exciting then when you got to hear it. You're having been through the blood, sweat, and tears of a scrap version, your concept being so strong in your own mind, and then finally getting to hear that first edit come in.
Yeah, it's, and what's really nice about the short trips that are, is that they have mostly the same composer and FX sound designer. So, you know, normally on a drama or on a project where there's a different sound designer and a different composer, you'll get the FX build, and you'll get the FX build down, and then you'll get the score. With this one, it was all in situ from the go. So we got all the theme tunes, we got the rewinding bullets, you know, we got that wonderful thing where I had to work out what the sentence was going to be, and then write out the sentence backward for the actor to read. Because if you reverse it, if you just reverse the audio, it wouldn't actually be them going backwards. It would just be sort of nonsense. So there's the text actually has it spelled out, the sentences backwards that they've got to read. So hearing that all come together was really nice. I think those effects really kind of came together as well in the edits. But yeah, it's always great to hear the edits. And also, like that, there's a shorter window for neuroses to set in. I'm very susceptible to when we have FX and music. I'll listen to the FX and go, oh no, what have I done? This is the worst Doctor Who ever. Yeah. And you get the next edit, you go, I am a genius, we have made gold. Cut the next edit. I'm an idiot, I'm a fool. And then you get the final music edit and go, oh, no, this is actually quite good, well done. So with this, it was such a short one that it was just like, oh, okay, yeah, no, this has come together well. I really like this. And yeah, it's, I think it's my partner's favorite. She read it. She hadn't heard the thing because she doesn't really like listening things. And I know it kind of, I sent it to a few, I tend to send scripts to a few, you know, there's a sort of big finish writing community and sort of check bits and pieces with each other. And I got some very nice things from Tim Foley as well before it went to record. And Scott went, you should write a book. This is excellent prose. Okay, thank you. So yeah, I'm really pleased that it's sort of a bit of an underdog one. I know people are sort of, it's a bit of a Marmite story, but it's one of my sort of secret favourites of mine. Yeah, I'm very proud of it, really.
You should be. I'm just having a quick scroll back through my text to see if I texted you when I heard it, and no, I didn't, which is, but I probably sent you an email, so there you go. It's I loved it, as you know. It's just clever, 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 to quote the cyber controller from Tomb of the Cybermen. Clever, clever, clever.
As we always do. We're always quoting that guy.
Exactly. Top man. And just great performances, Madel, and brilliant sound design and music. So, Alfie, it's been a joy as always. Thank you so much for sharing the insights into it.
Always a pleasure, Kenny. Come back anytime you'll have me. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We've also got a second chat for this episode, don't we? Because we're spoiling everyone.
We do. It's sad that it's not reader Adele Anderson, as I didn't ask her, quite frankly. But I do know the sound designer, Richard Fox, through my work with Big Finish. And here's Rich for a wee chat about what he recalls about it.
Hi, my name is Richard Fox. I'm the sound designer and composer on Death Will Not Part Us.
Welcome to the podcast. It's a joy to say hello to somebody new. So, hello, Richard.
Hello, Kenny. How you doing?
Very good, thank you. Very good. So, how do you find working on a short story, and or in this case, specifically a short trip, compared to something that's more full cast?
I think possibly the main difference is obviously you've got much less sound design and music cues to deal with, and it's the focus is on the narration rather than the audio drama and furling around you. So it's a question of knowing when to include sound design, when to include music, when to highlight what's going on in the text, and when to leave it well alone. So that's the main consideration when doing a short trip. For this particular one, I think there's a little bit more sound design, a little bit more soundscape than you would normally expect on a short trip, given the kind of nature of it, sort of time looping aspect of it. So, but mainly that's what you're trying to do. You're supporting the audio read rather than creating a world or creating a situation that hopefully, you know, you can bring forward the drama in the text.
So how do you find it? What's your process? Do you read through it, make some wee notes, and then take it from there?
I would do that with an audio drama for a short trip, because I'll be sound designing the whole thing. Editing the audio first anyway. So I will edit the audio, and from that I will obviously get a feel of the story. I will make notes as we go along. If there's anything particular, then I will just make sure that I'm aware of that when I come to sound design it. But because it's one voice, because it's a read similar to an audiobook, I will edit the audio, and then from that I will get my ideas. Once in a blue moon, though not with this particular one, there is a case whereby you will read the script and go through it before and make sure you've got some sound cues. But for the vast majority of short trips, including this, yeah, edit the audio, get a feel of the story, and then you can start working on the sound design.
So I take it that when you get something like this through, you've got the full edits, or you've got the full recording, so it's the various takes, and then working with the director's notes, assemble the dialogue edit first.
Yes, it doesn't really work too different from an audio drama, and you've obviously got multiple voices. We're getting a script, it's been marked up, whoever the director is, I think it was Scott in this case, it's marked up what takes to use. It's the same for any audio drama and audio book, and then at the end of that I'll have a completed audio read that I will then import into another folder and start my sound design process.
So what do you recall about working on this one? Because it is quite complex.
It is quite complex. What sticks out most about this one is the time looping aspect of it, the frequent use of the credits coming in at various intervals because of that time looping nature during the course of the short trip. So that already marks this one out as being slightly different. The way the story is told it's one of my more favourite ones actually, because of that aspect of it and the way it's sort of shifting eras in terms of Doctor Who. So you've got theme tunes from the War Doctor, and obviously you finish with the Eighth Doctor in situ. So all those sort of things bring a slightly different aspect to this particular short trip. But I do remember this one in particular. I've done quite a few short trips now, Kenny, to be honest. I've probably done about 10 to 20 of them. So, you know, it's when you've worked on a lot of projects, not all of them stand out, but this one particularly does because of its nature and because of the way it was structured. So it's slightly different in that regard.
I suppose in some ways, the fact you've got a wedding as a sort of the main setting for it, that sort of helps you in a shorthand, because we all know what a wedding sounds like.
Yeah, well, for the short trips, that's quite a big deal, because you're using fairly minimal sound, if there is something to sort of hang your coat on, so to speak. So for this, I think it would be the church bell. So every time the church bells come back in, you're aware of where you are and what you're doing, and as you say, immediately gives you that wedding feel. And some of the other ones, it depends. But if you've got a background or some sort of wash to go underneath a certain scene to keep bringing you back, they're the sort of things that you're looking for in the sound design for a short trip in order to make the audio stand out a little bit more.
I suppose in some ways that also sort of lends itself for the music, given that you've got a wedding, so you can have that sort of the romantic sort of sounds to start with. And then, of course, things don't quite go to plan.
Absolutely, yeah. So there are music cues that reflect that, and you know, for a lot of short trips, the music cues are kept normally to linking scenes, but there are bits where you can underscore it, and as you say, that there's a whole passage, I think, of solo piano later on. So those aspects of the composing don't come in so much in a short trip, but when they do, you hope they can reflect what's going on, as you say, the romantic side to it, and obviously that's tempered against the violent nature of what's about to happen to them as well. So you know, it all develops hopefully as you go across the process.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes is it when you're reading it, do you sort of get sort of ideas and melodies into your head to think, oh, that's something that might work, and then jot it down or do a quick bum ba dum bum bum, record something for yourself just to work in?
Sometimes. What normally suggests itself to me composing when I go through the process of either editing or reading a script is instrumentation more than themes. And then the instrumentation can dictate more so with the theme you want to put in. So, yeah, I think in several short trips, I try not to go overboard with the composition because, as I say, it's mainly about telling the story. The vast majority of the short trip is without score. But when the score comes in, you want it to, you know, push through and bring you to the next scene, or if it's in a particular scene itself, is to create that emotion. So, yeah, it's normally about instrumentation. So as you read a script, listen to the performance as well, because each individual reader brings different things to a read. That can also suggest whether you want strings or piano or whatever it is you're after. So I think in this particular case that again that suggested that reflective side, particularly at the end with the solo piano, I think that was suggested by listening to Adele's performance and reading the script, and after I've edited it, that so after that the theme sort of come from the instrumentation that you pick.
Do you recall there being any particular issues along the way, or was it a fairly straightforward process because you know what you're doing?
A lot of it's straightforward. Getting hold of themes, that's always something to be. I don't know if you've spoken to the other big Finnish sound designers, but there's always this notion of trying to get hold of themes. So I didn't have the War Doctor theme. I had to scrounge around trying to find that, and then getting the right different themes in the right place. That's always seems to be my Achilles heel, that, Kenny, to be honest. I always seem to be people saying, oh, that's not the right, that's the theme from season 6 rather than season 5. Those sort of things, and the slight differences, or that's the Dominic Glynn Sixth Doctor one, not the Peter Howe one. So those sort of things. So just getting those right themes and getting them in the right place. I recall that being not tricky in terms of sound, but tricky in terms of chasing up those themes and probably knocking on Howard's door or someone like that who had done the War Doctor. Those sort of things, and saying, please, can I have this? I need to do this. I've got to deliver it on Thursday. So those sort of things, they stand out, that the change in themes and era's themes during the course of the production.
Blooming fans and their need to be accurate, but we must be correct.
Must be correct. It's an edict that comes through in all these things, and I'm sure it hasn't been 100% over the whole of Big Finish's history. But yeah, this we're always trying to get the right thing, the right era, the right theme, the right sound. There's banks on online from various fantastic members of the sound design community who have Third Doctor think, Fourth Doctor, Fifth. So it's all in there. We just have to try and sort of track it down sometimes. But, you know, we always try to be accurate, Kenny.
So how happy are you with it when you look back on it now? Because I think it's a very complete package. And the fact that it's stop, start, and it really does throw you. And I think that's what makes it work, because it's so clever that way. You've got to pay attention.
Well, that's right. So I'm always working on something new. So I actually listened to this yesterday for the first time since I completed it and, you know, uploaded it to the FTP to go out. So I was, you know, looking back, I'm pretty happy with it, actually. There's more opportunity there for sound, as I said, more opportunity for score than a vast majority of other short trips. It's an excellent story, as I said, well told by Adele and well directed by Scott. So all of those things actually converge to make it one of my more favourite short trips that I've worked on, and one that stands out a bit more than some of the other ones I've done, with no disrespect to those. It's just, you know, the nature of this story and the way it's told slightly differently as a short trip from some of the other stories sort of, I think it's probably one of my more favourite projects to have worked on.
Rich, that's been fantastic. Thanks so much for your time.
No worries, lovely. Thank you.
Thanks to Alfie and Rich for their time and for bringing this week's episode to life. And remember, if you've enjoyed today's Pieces of Eighth, or indeed liked any episode we've done, please do leave a review for us on iTunes or your podcast provider, as it means more people can find our episodes, which would be rather nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Share the love. And you can follow the podcast on Twitter at Pieces of Eighth. And we have our Facebook group too, so feel free to send us a request to join it and find out what we've got coming up, as well as some general chit-chat.
We certainly do. And of course, where can people find you on Twitter, Matt, for your fantastic reviews of every Doctor Who story ever?
Oh, yes, I am at @the_cybermatt.
I would hugely recommend that people follow you and read your reviews, because they're great and they're thought-provoking and they'll make you think, yeah, very, very good. And I think you're nice about everything. You always try and find a positive, which I think is great, when so many people tend not to. So well done to you.
Thank you.
We'll be back with the penultimate episode in the series next week as we return to the world of comics and investigate a strip which some people may have ironically forgotten that the Eighth Doctor appeared in. It's The Forgotten from IDW, and we'll be speaking with the writer, Tony Lee, which was actually a chat from Gallifrey. I didn't know Tony was going to be there, but I saw him there and I thought, I'm going to nab you. He was up for it, so we got a bonus interview that was never planned. So, until next time, I've been Kenny Smith.
Well, I was Matt Michael.
Bye-bye.
Bye.